Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Heisman hype is heating up. The National Hockey League and the NBA are beginning to grind their way out of the warm-up laps. This weekend, or perhaps next, some few NFL teams have got to burst from the pack and establish themselves as contenders. And as if all that is not enough, it's time for college basketball to begin. Joining me now from his office in Louisville, Kentucky, is Pat Forte, basketball scribe for the Louisville Courier-Journal and for ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Glad to be here, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to have the basketball season on the screen again, isn't it?
Always. Love to hear the bouncing of the ball. Weather starts getting a little colder. It's time to go inside.
The two teams that everybody's talking about this year are Kansas and Arizona. Why these two?
They're relics, basically. They're products of a bygone era. They're both veteran teams with seniors and, you know, these unheard-of guys that stick around for 4 years and actually, I suppose, are threatening to get a degree or two. And, you know, in today's day and age, if you can keep a group of pretty good players around, and some of these guys are very good, you've got a real leg up on everybody else. The elite kind of break down into almost two categories this year, and that's the teams that have kept around some seniors and then the teams that are really young and precocious, like Duke and Florida.
Well, let's go right to the teams that are really young and precocious because, of course, when players leave early, it becomes more and more important to recruit that great freshman, even if he'll only be there for a little while.
Absolutely, and Florida got off to that kind of start in the preseason NIT this past week. They have so many freshmen that we had kind of all forgotten about, this kind of pasty kid from Pennsylvania named Matt Walsh, who turned around, scored 26 points, and just kind of jumped out of nowhere in their opening game of the preseason NIT. And reminds you that, I mean, they've got seven freshmen. This guy was maybe about the sixth most heralded out of that group, and if he can score 26, they have a whole lot of players down there. And Duke is the other team where, you know, they just recruit wave after wave of high school All-Americans, and they're going to have a chance, I think, to be real good as well. And you're right, that's kind of the way the game is now. Duke lost three different guys to the NBA draft last year, and that you're just going to have to keep kind of plugging gaps eternally. I mean, recruiting is going to become even more pressurized, I think, for coaches because the turnover's so high now.
For those of our listeners who may not have the proper electronic equipment to watch 11 basketball games a day long into the early morning, give me the names of some great new players, freshmen maybe, who they should be especially aware of as the opportunity to see these guys comes along.
Okay. We mentioned Matt Walsh from Florida, who got off to a blazing start and also plays in the backcourt with a young man named Anthony Roberson. They're going to be quite a tandem to watch. And they also have a third freshman from Denmark named Christian Dreyer, who turned down a $1 million offer from Spain to play in the pro leagues in Spain to come to school at Florida. And he's supposed to be just sensational. He's been injured, but when he gets on the floor, watch for him. Secondly, a guy named Carmelo Anthony for Syracuse, who got off to a great start. I believe he had 27 points in their opening game and should be just spectacular as well. Memphis has a couple of freshmen who really I hadn't even heard that much about, but played very well in their early game. They defeated Syracuse, in fact, and it was kind of an all-freshman show there. So, you know, and as usual, there's going to be a bunch of guys all over the place, and then some of them who will just kind of gradually come out and we'll notice them as they go along, but those are the main names right now.
One intriguing thing about this season seems to me that lots of schools that are very well known for football prowess and have good basketball teams but often not great basketball teams are kind of being looked at pretty seriously. Pittsburgh, Texas, Alabama, places like that.
Yeah, Oklahoma as well, which went to the Final Four last year. And it is very interesting, and I think it just goes to show that teams that are in the BCS leagues in football are going to get some windfall in basketball as well. You're going to, you know, you're making more money. You're going to be able to build nicer facilities. Kids like to come to places with nicer facilities. You're going to get on TV more. It just kind of all feeds on itself and on each other. And I think that's the nature of the game now, is the haves are going to have more and the have-nots are going to be a little more distanced. I think one of the best examples of that, Bill, just this past week, Xavier, which everybody had picked in the top 10, was playing Stanford, whom nobody picked in the top 25 in the preseason NIT, and they made Xavier go across three time zones to play at Stanford. Stanford beat them. You know, but Stanford's in the Pac-10, and Xavier's in the Atlantic 10. They're not one of the haves. They don't necessarily have the cachet to have those kind of home games.
Everybody knows that in college football, the great teams play patsies for the first 3 or 4 or 5 weeks of the season to pad their records to get ready for whoever they're going to have to play later on. Is that as true of basketball teams at the top level?
Yes and no. It's definitely not as true from the standpoint that everybody nowadays at least schedules a few pretty good games because they know strength of schedule counts a whole lot in terms of seeding at the end of the year, and you can go ahead and lose some games, whereas in football, everybody's scared to death to lose games, and everybody wants those home games for the home revenue, since football is the ultimate cash cow. But every basketball team will still manage to schedule anywhere from 3 to 10 absolute walkover patsies. You know, they're Pine Bluff will be busy. Prairie View will be busy. There will be in demand for a lot of the big name teams to come in and beat 124-60 and, you know, make the fans feel good and get the, you know, the free cheeseburger you get or whatever when this team goes over the 100 mark.
Pat, it's far too early, of course, to start picking Final Four candidates, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway, and I promise I won't make fun of you several months hence.
You can make fun of me right now because Xavier was my preseason number one, and they've already lost. So. But I was out pretty far on a limb with that one anyway. Clearly, the two teams that everybody likes are Arizona and Kansas, and for that reason, being a contrarian, I don't like either of them. I can see Arizona making the Final Four. I'll take them. I will take Florida. I will take Texas. And what the heck, I'll stick by Xavier and say that this was just an early blip. It's November. By late March, they'll be okay, and they'll redeem me.
Losing was the best thing that could have happened
to
him, right?
There you go, the old cliche. Let's hope it's true.
Pat Forte covers college basketball for the Louisville Courier-Journal and ESPN.com. He's also a regular on Only a Game. Pat, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Bill. Happy hoops.
The University of Florida, Florida State, the University of Miami, the Sunshine State has not lacked for accomplished college football teams. And now, Florida International University, previously known for attracting international students rather than monstrous linemen and flashy tailbacks, has established a Division I AA football program to the bemusement of many students. From Miami, Kayvon Antonio Haydari has the story.
Good afternoon, FIU football.
In the shadow of Florida International University's community stadium, a small trailer houses the offices of the school's football coach, former Dolphin Don Strock, and his staff. But the modest facility belies the school's big ambitions. It's late August, and Florida International is playing its first game ever against St. Peter's of New Jersey. The band plays, and benefactors beam with optimism at the birth of a football program. Behind the end zone, local alumni sit with foreign students watching the Panthers' 27-3 victory. Vittoria Pisqueda and Josef Garay, FIU doctoral candidates from Italy and Hungary, respectively, are watching their first ever football game. Although they're confused about some of the action, they do know the Panthers are winning handily. Pisqueda says a crash course has given her enough expertise to be conversant with the rules of football.
Before coming here, I printed out from the web all the rules of the American football, and I was explaining him all the rules, and now I'm asking around to everybody to tell me, is it true this is the score is right or not? So now I almost understood everything.
Josef Garay, a doctoral candidate in geophysics, feels it's not necessary to know a lot about football rules to appreciate the game's essence.
I think you want to get the flavor of real America, so you come and watch the football game.
Freshman Reza Hagiki, a student from Sweden and a football neophyte, agrees, although he places school pride above the game itself.
We have to be here to support our school because this is something important. Even we are not that big fan of football, American football, because I'm from Sweden, but this is amazing and this is just something nice for school, and I mean, this is unbelievable. Great time, great time.
The Panthers are currently 5-5, so FIU's first football season can be considered a modest success. But whether it can or should ever attain the mythic status enjoyed by the University of Miami, which boasts the only other college football team in town, seems uncertain. The Hurricanes are seeking their sixth national championship in the last 20 seasons. FIU would be happy with 6 wins this season. Miami budgets $12 million for football each year. FIU, on the other hand, spends less than $10 million annually for all its athletic programs. Miami football is headquartered in a state-of-the-art building in which coaches and players have their own specialized meeting rooms. Florida International has the trailer. FIU defensive back Kevin Timothy played high school football in nearby Fort Lauderdale, but didn't know of FIU's existence until the school recruited him.
I never heard of it. They sent me a letter, and it was like FAU was sending letters. I knew they were starting out, but then I was like, FIU, when are they supposed to be starting?
Bring on your one!
Whether Florida International will ever make the jump to Division 1A status and rival the University of Miami in local or national attention is one question. But whether the school students want that is another matter. FIU junior Justo Hernandez from Nicaragua studies communications. He loves baseball, soccer, and other sports. However,
I'm really indifferent to a football team, you know, to football, to the whole football team. FIU has more other interesting things, you know, so I really don't care about football. It's fine. Football can be, you know, can be here, but I don't care.
But for every skeptic on the FIU campus, there seems to be a new believer, at least for now. And optimism is a quality that crosses the barriers of nationality and language.
That's done. C'est bon.
Florida International's fans will have their final opportunity of the year to wish their team bonne chance when the Panthers take on Florida Atlantic at Pro Player Stadium today. For Only a Game, I'm Kevan Antonio Haidari in Miami.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Shall we dance? Shall we dance till the last little star has left the sky? More than 200 dancers from the St. Petersburg Ballet School recently completed a 24-hour ballet marathon, while thousands of spectators chowed down on snacks, drank beer, and cheered lustily. The dancers spun across the stage where Rudolf Nureyev and Mikhail Baryshnikov had performed under more reserved conditions. The event was staged as part of the celebration of St. Petersburg's 300th anniversary, and it delighted soloist Anna Fokina. "The atmosphere is great. The audience is perfect," she said of the marathon. "It is not important whether you dance in the daytime or the night. The important thing is the dancing and the public."
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. In the news, there were more riots in Nigeria today, even after organizers of the Miss Universe pageant decided to pull the pageant out of that West African nation. To read more, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Toyota, featuring the Toyota Prius, the four-door hybrid gas-electric-powered sedan, available at a New England Toyota dealer during their 13th annual Thanksgiving event. Trader Joe's, a unique grocery store where buyers travel the world for products like smoked Atlantic salmon, non-alcoholic sparklers, and imported chocolate. More at TraderJoe's.com. And Nixon Peabody LLP, providing legal services to local, national, and global businesses with offices in the East and in California. On the web at nixonpeabody.com. It's 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, crushing, cutting, covering up, things of that nature. But first, organizing, publicizing, and selling the Olympic Games is an enormous business endeavor. Many athletes and fans applaud those efforts as necessary to the celebration of excellence and achievement that the Olympic spectacle is supposed to be. Dissenters, such as Helen Jefferson Lenski, whose most recent book is about the social impacts of the Sydney Olympics, view the production of the Games in another light. Ms. Lenski, the author of The Best Olympics Ever? Joins me now from the CBC studios in Toronto. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
As you picked your title, The Best Olympics Ever? Did you have in mind a real previous Olympics that was the best, or maybe a future Olympics that would be?
Not really. I was
quoting Samaranch, who is always sort of treated like the oracle at Delphi. You know, before a city hosts the games, he'll say, "This has the potential to be the best Olympics ever." And everyone waits with bated breath until the closing ceremony. And then he stands up and he either says this was the best Olympics ever, or in the case of Atlanta, he said this was an excellent Olympics. and it's as if organizers or spectators or the residents of the state are apparently not in a position to judge. It's one man's statement that puts the IOC seal of approval on a Games as being the best ever. But I was judging by different criteria, and I was also asking best for whom.
You write in the introduction, Helen, that part of your goal is to discuss, quote, the real Olympic costs and impacts, which both the Olympic industry itself and the mainstream press have not much discussed. In your opinion, how have the IOC and the National Olympic Committees been negligent or dishonest in discussions of cost and impact?
Well, there are many, many ways of formulating an Olympic budget, and when it suits their interests, the Olympic bid committees, organizing committees, Olympic boosters will say that the only costs that should go down on paper are the costs of mounting the 16-day sporting event. At other times, when it suits their interests, they'll say that the Olympics is about urban development and infrastructure development, puts the city, the host city, on the international tourist map and so on. And typically, infrastructure improvements to airports, highways, new construction of facilities that, in the case of Sydney and many other recent host cities, turn out to be white elephants almost the day that the Olympics leave town. All of those costs don't show up on most Olympic budgets because they're seen as a so-called legacy. Hmm. And I really object to the term legacy. Legacy sounds like a gift from the gods that is suddenly dropped on the lucky recipients. Taxpayers pay for the so-called legacy, so it's not a gift. You pay for it, you get it, if you wanted it or not. Do you want a velodrome? Do you want a ski jump and so on?
So that sometimes this building project or many projects are gifts to the contractors and to the people who own the companies who are doing the building, but perhaps not to anybody else.
Yes, and then they're built with public money and very often privatized very soon after the Olympics leave town. And I documented in the Sydney book an aquatic center in a suburb called Ryde. That suburb used to be served with about 5 public pools in this one complex, and they were open to the public for a small fee. And all of those 5 were demolished to make way for the water polo pool for the Olympics and a couple of other pools. And then half of the new complex was privatized, sold to a private leisure club that now operates it for profit. So the residents of Ryde ended up with a net loss after all of the so-called legacy fell out.
You write that in the 5 years leading up to the Sydney Games, quote, core spending in health, education, welfare, and transport had suffered. I gather this is because money necessary to prepare for and publicize the Games took away from the budgets for those other important areas. Is this something that has happened with other local and national economies as well?
It's certainly true that the lion's share of a state's budget for infrastructure and for maintaining basic social services and sort of things like repairing roads, that kind of thing, the lion's share gets directed at the host city, and other parts of that state very often suffer for many years. And in the case of New South Wales, the state that hosted the Sydney Olympics, there was sort of a gentleman's agreement among some of the politicians that if it's Olympics, it's a yes. So the sort of quid pro quo was after the Olympics, the regions outside of the Sydney metropolitan area would get some of that spending that they had lost for 4 or 5 years preceding the Games. Now, whether that really happens or not is to be seen.
One issue underlying the Sydney Games was the matter of historical reconciliation or lack of same between the Indigenous community of Australia and the white establishment. To what extent did that make the Sydney Games unusual, the presence of that issue?
From the start, there were mixed political positions on the part of Aboriginal communities. There were some who were completely supportive of the Olympic bid, and at the other end of the political spectrum, there were more militant Aboriginal people who decided to use that opportunity to bring international attention to the fact that, well, what how they would term it would be 212 years of genocide, 212 years of white oppression, white colonization. So there was the very visible presence in the cultural program, the opening and closing ceremonies, and the huge amount of media attention directed at Kathy Freeman in particular, and the very clever move to have her light the cauldron. You know, as I said in the book, a lot of my colleagues who understand race relations the same way I do talked to me the day after the opening ceremonies and said, wow, wasn't it great Kathy Freeman lit the flame? This signifies a step towards, you know, the end of racism in Australia. And I said, I don't think so. While the world saw a huge representation of Aboriginal peoples in the opening and closing ceremonies, what the viewing, international viewing audiences didn't see was that deaths in custody continued. And in the case of the Northern Territory, almost as soon as the international media had flown back to their home countries, some new legislation made life for Indigenous people in the Northern Territory even worse than it had been before.
You charge at several points in your book that civil rights were violated before and during the Sydney Games, that the New South Wales government, quote, gave police virtually arbitrary powers and suspended Australians' basic rights to freedom of assembly. Have you specific examples of rights violations?
Yes. I talk about some friends and colleagues from the Anti-Olympic Alliance who did this partly as a sort of test. They had flyers that said, you have been handed an illegal flyer, and then it talked about the legislation that made it illegal to hand out flyers in certain locales. And they were in a downtown Sydney area called Martin Place, which was designated an Olympic Live site. It had one of those jumbo screens. As it was designated an Olympic Live site, it was subject to the full force of a whole raft of legislation around public behaviour, protests, that kind of thing. So, strictly speaking, they weren't allowed to hand out political pamphlets to people. So they were threatened with arrest simply for peacefully circulating through the crowd, handing out pieces of paper. And even in the last week, there's been a World Trade Organization meeting in Homebush Bay, the exact site of the 2000 Olympics. And very conveniently, the vast majority of the legislation that in theory was enacted just for the duration of the Olympics, in practice, has either 2 years or 4 years duration, or in some cases, no sunset clause. So Homebush Bay was a great place to host the WTO because protesters could be arrested for sneezing there.
As a result of the bribery scandals that came to light before the Olympics in Salt Lake City, some members of the IOC were removed. Various new rules regarding the choosing of Olympic sites came into being. Do any of the changes of that time address your concerns about the impact of the Games?
No, the IOC takes this, you know, what looks like moral high ground but isn't, to say that they're concerned about the sporting event, they're concerned about the cultural program and the environmental aspects. Those are the three pillars of what they call Olympism. And when a friend of mine from Bread Not Circuses, Michael Shapcott, and I talked to IOC Vice President Richard Pound, this was about 4 years back, we had this conversation and said, you've just introduced environmental issues as the third pillar. What about social impacts? Why don't you require that bid committees put forward a plan about mitigating against the worst social impacts or something of that kind? And he said, well, the IOC would be considered to be intervening in domestic politics if it started to develop guidelines or make requirements about the social side, because not every bidding city is part of a democratic society. And there is this notion of bringing developing countries into the fold. And, well, this was his argument, that if you had social impact requirements, a country like China would pretty much be disqualified. Perhaps Korea would have too. So that was the sort of response that we got. But really, there is no interest on the part of the IOC to deal with social impacts. That's a domestic issue from their perspective. And they don't really worry too much one way or another unless some social impact is going to bring very negative publicity to the IOC, and then they might intervene.
Helen Jefferson-Lenski is the author of The Best Olympics Ever? Social Impacts of Sydney 2000. Helen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Rock breaks scissors, scissors cut paper, paper covers rock. Remember? Pete Lovering does. He's been recently crowned the Rock, Paper, Scissors Champion of the World, and he joins me now from his office in Toronto. Pete, welcome to Only a Game.
How do you do?
Very well, thank you. I'm curious about, I'm told you're in your office in Toronto. This is not your rock, paper, scissors office, I gather. What do you do?
Well, it's fast become the headquarters for the rock, paper, scissors. There's a lot of excitement around the office when I brought in the news on Monday, I guess.
This is the news that you had become the champion.
Yes.
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 And your colleagues didn't feel that this would be a danger to, I mean, draw you away from whatever other work you're supposed to be doing?
Oh, gosh, it's totally drawn me away from my other work. I mean, it's almost like a vacation, working vacation. They've been very good. The company's been very good to sort of let me run with it and field interviews throughout the week and what have you. So,
well, what are you supposed to be doing?
What am I supposed to be doing? Well, I should be on the telephone selling Job Shark, which is the company I work for, to recruiters, you know, selling, sales manager, that sort of stuff, you know. So, no, I haven't been doing my job fully, I must admit.
Tell me a little about how one trains for a rock, paper, scissors competition. Do you have a sparring partner or something?
Well, I think everybody's significant other is probably their closest sparring partner, or maybe their niece or nephew, you know, that sort of thing. I was practicing a bit beforehand. I played all my life, you know, so whether it's deciding what restaurant to go to or, you know, who gets the last slice of pizza. what we're getting, a lot of people are into patterns, though, but I trained by just trying to focus on concentrating on what I was throwing and just get really, just try to concentrate as hard as I could on what I was going to throw.
Now, how does it work in a championship? Do you have to win 2 out of 3 throws to win a match, or are there sets?
No,
or?
Yeah, well, there was, it's similar to tennis. It's 2 out of 3 throws make a set, and all the preliminary rounds up until the final four in the finals were 2 out of 3 sets made a match. And then in the semifinals and finals, it was 3 out of 5 sets made the match.
Fatigue come into it at all?
Yeah, I think so. I think there was it was hot. It was very tense. And, yeah, my arm got a little sore, but I was actually, no, it didn't really get that sore.
Now, what does one get for winning the World Rock, Paper, Scissors Championship? Is there a trophy? Or?
Oh, I got a great trophy. I won Microsoft Xbox. I got a bunch of Molson products and 1,200 Canadian dollars.
That's terrific. Who knew this was there was a professional opportunity here?
Well, no, and the exciting thing is that it's just like it's just captured the imagination of a nation, you know, in many ways. It's just like people are going crazy about it. I'm a B celebrity right now, you know. And that's and who would ever have thought that? Even my dad jokes. He's like, gosh, my own son has turned into a superstar. I never thought that would ever happen legally.
Now, I gather that you will be the World Rock, Paper, Scissors champion for roughly a year until there's another championship. How do you plan to use your platform?
I'm going to use it to do as much, try to bring about world peace, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how, but, you know, but helping decision makers avoid conflict over the years, you know, I think that's, maybe we can apply this to, you know, the UN, or maybe it can be used in, get your president there to use it with his friend over in the Middle East. And, yeah, I'd like to do something with it. You know, if I get a couple of free trips to New York out of it, I think that'll be pretty worthwhile.
Peter Levering is the World Rock, Paper, Scissors Society's international champion. Peter, thanks again for joining us. Congratulations and good luck.
All right. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Nature Conservancy, using science and partnerships to achieve conservation in Massachusetts and beyond, on the web at nature.org. By Direct Tire and Auto Service, featuring Toyo tires for cars, vans, or SUVs, located in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick. DirectTire.com or 1-800-TIRE-PRO. And by the Music Emporium, music enthusiast celebrating the craft of guitar building, with more than 200 instruments available in their Lexington showroom, themusicemporium.com. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Celtics beat the Hawks 105-98 in double overtime at the Fleet Center last night. The two teams play again tonight, this time in Atlanta. The Bruins are at the Fleet Center tonight, hosting the Buffalo Sabres. Harvard and Yale square off this afternoon at Harvard Stadium in the 119th edition of the famed Ivy League rivalry known simply as The Game. Yale has the most wins in the series. In other college action, the Atlantic 10 title and tournament berths are on the line today. Maine and Northeastern tied for lead in the conference take on New Hampshire and James Madison, respectively. Tune in to WBUR tomorrow afternoon at 3 as we begin a special five-part series from the BBC examining Muslims today trying to reconcile their faith with the demands of modern society. That's Muslims and Modernity tomorrow afternoon at 3 on 90.9 WBUR. 39 degrees, light rain in Boston at 7:39.
Consider all the times you turned to WBUR for coverage of the news that's occurred in 2002. Your continued financial support is what makes that coverage possible. I'm Gina Cervetti. When our letter comes to you in the mail asking for your contribution, please send it in with a check. For a pledge of $175, that's just 50 cents a day, we'll send you a coupon for two free lift tickets at Sunday River Ski Resort. It's our way of saying thanks for supporting the news you'll turn to in the year to come.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, four-wheeling and two-wheeling in the mud with Mom and Dad. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
I don't know, but that sounds vaguely Freudian.
The ongoing effort to bring more minority candidates to management positions in the National Football League got a boost from the Players Union this week. The union's executive director, Gene Upshaw, has appointed a committee to help identify minority candidates for coaching positions. Is this going to nudge owners into hiring minorities?
Well, it's apparently going to nudge Gene Upshaw into doing something he should have done years ago. He is already on record against the proposed lawsuit. As anybody who's ever worked anywhere near government will tell you, any committee is the hat into which the rabbit goes and disappears forever. So I think basically what this committee is going to do is help to defuse the issue for the foreseeable future.
New York Giants cornerback Jason Sehorn had harsh words for the NFL's drug policy this week, Charlie. He said, quote, if they want to do us some favors, do some serious testing on stuff everybody in the league takes, stuff prescribed by the doctors. What do you suppose he had in mind?
And then he was hit over the head with a baseball bat, stuffed in a sack, and mailed to Shanghai.
Disappeared into the same hat as the committee thing.
This is the dirty secret of the NFL, and everybody knows it. As it is presently constituted and as the way the game is played, if you allowed testing for every drug and you didn't allow players to take any drug prior to going on the field, you wouldn't have a football season. Painkillers, corticosteroids, they're prescribed like M&Ms all over the NFL. The NFL knows it. Its philosophy behind its drug testing is incoherent because you cannot make the argument that it is morally incorrect and ethically incorrect to take a drug to enhance your performance while simultaneously arguing that it's perfectly morally fine to take a drug that makes that performance possible. Jason Sehorn is on the right track. He will be ignored even more thoroughly than Gene Upshaw's committee will be.
For 22 games next season, Puerto Rico may have a major league team. A plan is afoot for the temporarily Montreal Expos to play a quarter of its home season in San Juan. If enough folks show up, does the team become the San Juan Expos?
One hesitates to blow one's own horn here on National Public Radio because we are the common reason voice of sports radio. But I would point out that this is merely a temporizing move before my grand design of moving the Montreal Expos permanently to Havana comes to fruition in a couple of years. I appreciate Bud Selig's attempt to lay the groundwork for my plan, but we are not staying in San Juan. We are moving on to Havana.
Spoken like a man with a vested interest in a baseball team and some nice warm weather place.
Beachfront property.
Early in the week, the New York Times editorial page included a call for Tiger Woods to boycott the Masters golf tournament. I don't suppose you were surprised when Tiger said he thought perhaps he wouldn't do that.
No, I've been surprised by the level of ignorance this issue has stirred up among the cattle of American sports fans. Should Tiger Woods take a stand on this issue? Absolutely. He's the one who played the discrimination card in one of his very early Nike commercials. You can't go all the way out on the limb and then walk back in. That having been said, I think the New York Times was extremely soft on the rest of the golf tour. Tiger Woods does not have more of an obligation to speak out on this than do Phil Mickelson or Mark O'Meara or Ernie Els or Vijay Singh or any of the others. He simply has a more acutely sharpened one given the marketing campaign that was engaged on his behalf early in his career.
A candidate for best pro basketball story of the week, it seems to me, as of the previous week, is the Dallas Mavericks. Not all that many NBA teams have begun a season 12-0. So I'm wondering, should the Lakers, Kings at all be concerned?
Oh, absolutely. They should be concerned. Dallas still has to prove it can win when every shot is contested in the playoffs. Sean Bradley, the 7-foot-6-inch heretofore waste of time, has had a very useful season so far. We'll see if that will carry through into the new year. Shaquille O'Neal has not yet played a game. That certainly has something to do with it. But they are a very entertaining team, and I think that anybody who hasn't changed their mind upon Dallas owner Mark Cuban by now is fooling themselves. He does exactly what you expect a sports owner to do. For the fans that pay the money, he puts a very entertaining product on the floor.
Yao Ming, breakout game Thursday night?
Absolutely. I bow to my colleague at the Boston Globe named Bob Ryan on this. He was ahead of this guy. It wasn't just simply that Yao Ming had 30 points and 16 rebounds against what is the best team so far in the NBA. It's the way he did it. It wasn't his little turnaround jump shot. It was power moves over people. He completely outclassed Sean Bradley, who went back to being the waste of space, by the way, at least for one night. And the first time he and the big Aristotle tee it up, I will be in front of my screen with the popcorn.
Philadelphia 76ers star Allen Iverson said this week that although he, quote, wants to be in Philadelphia, he is, quote, scared to be there because, and I'm quoting again, Allen Iverson could end up dead tomorrow if a crooked cop wants him dead. A legitimate fear?
You know what? I think so. Not so much in the specific sense of Allen Iverson, but Philadelphia did have a corrupt police department. They did have a precinct in which false confessions were coerced at the point of a gun. They did have a precinct that's paying out millions and millions of dollars in damages from innocent people that were railroaded. I think Allen Iverson should strictly observe the speed limit for the entire time he's in Philadelphia.
Finally, Charlie, if the mark of a great athlete is adjusting to unforeseen adversity, Joseph Smith of the Belmont Cub Scout Pack in Durham City, England, qualifies as such. He arrived at a swim meet last week, learned that the rest of his team had failed to show up, and decided to compete anyway. Then he went out and won the 25-meter freestyle, breaststroke, backstroke, and butterfly events, and then he recruited some guys from another team and won the 100-meter relay final.
Don't you hate selfish athletes who are only in it for themselves?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He sits atop the list here at Only a Game each week. Thank you, Charlie.
Good on you, lad.
On the best days of our games, they provide kid athletes with hours of fun and help youngsters learn self-confidence and teamwork. Those of us who enjoy sports like to think games can help kids through tough times as well. Sometimes, as commentator Alyssa Eli recently noticed, we're wrong.
The girls were deep in conversation over their chalk art on the sidewalk, collaborating on a rainbow. One girl starts on the left end, the other on the right. Somehow their contiguous arcs of color meet in the middle with absolute compatibility. They perfected this over 3 years of preschool together. It always works out. My new school is full of kids we already knew, said Natasha. Olivia and Alec are in gym class, and Aaron's taking dancing lessons with me in after school. My little girl said nothing, but the purple chalk shook slightly. There's a lot of exercise in this school, Natasha said. Kate's there, too. She's a bad dancer. What's wrong with your face? The purple chalk hit the sidewalk. Stop talking about it, Rebecca said. I still don't know anyone in my new school. How do you think I feel? Natasha made an excellent therapeutic effort. You'll make friends, she said. Rebecca shook her head. Sure, said Natasha. When you're 100, you'll have a ton of friends. Rebecca said nothing. In her sufficient and self-assured world, it was the first time I had heard doubt. Rain was starting to fall in sunny Eden. That night, in the quiet moments before sleep, when textbooks claim parent and child are closest, I brought it up. I know you're worried about kindergarten, I said. Not knowing everyone yet and all, but you'll be doing so much together, dancing and kickball and taekwondo and gym. I don't want to talk about it, she said. That was easy. It's my business to know how to answer that. Her words were a door cracked open. I put my hand on the knob and turned. Lovey, I said, when people talk about their worries out loud, they're less lonely. This remark is not only encouraging, but fortunately true. Maybe if you tell me what's on your mind, you'll feel better. Most people do. Not me, she said. I heard the small sound of something shutting. The laws of motion had met an immovable object. Not me, she said, and that's that. Leaving Eden is a solitary journey. It's unsaved by kickball and taekwondo and even dancing. That is just that.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist and writer living near Boston.
Fall is here, hear the yell. Back to school, ring the bell. Brand new shoes, walking blues. Climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
On an October weekend at Loretta Lynn's Dude Ranch in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee, it might be logical to expect to hear some country music. But during the last weekend of October, had you been in Hurricane Mills, you'd have heard the whining, roaring, sputtering engines of dirt bikes instead. Only a game's witness to that fact is reluctant daredevil producer Hal Humphreys, who has this story.
At their campsite, early on a cool Saturday morning, two sleepy-eyed, bedheaded families array themselves around the breakfast fire. As they cook up scrambled eggs and bacon, I ask them how long they've been at this business of dirt bike riding. Shy 9-year-old Daniel Anderson speaks first.
How long have you been riding, Daniel?
About since I was four or five.
How old are you now?
9.
How long have you guys been riding? How long have you been riding?
Since I was 9.
And how old are you now?
29.
Yeah, right.
40, be 43 in May.
Right on. And you, how long have you been riding?
37 years.
Do you ride a lot?
But I'm 29 also.
But the mandatory riders meeting doesn't start for an excruciating 30 minutes. With the sun peeking over a ridge of green hills lighting the campground hollow, Daniel Anderson admits he's already taken his bike for a spin.
I already rode it today and slid out and hurt my leg.
Across a rutted gravel lane, Daniel Anderson and his bedraggled companion shuffle into a pavilion for the mandatory 8 o'clock meeting.
Each rider must register. If you haven't registered yet, you need to go through registration. You sign a release, they give you an armband, and you give us some money.
Over 1,000 riders, from nimble 4-year-olds to anxious old-timers, cram into the pavilion. But they're ready to saddle up and ride. After a dry recitation of the rules, they're off to the hill. The Redlands rolling wooded playground encompasses 800 acres. There's a 3/4-mile kiddie loop with one whopping big hill. Then there's the expert track, 16 miles of winding, undulating, thrilling, and intimidating trails. Riders file by one at a time and in groups, moms, dads, kids of all ages. Some of them scream by, and others putter along. And if you look close enough, you can spot some of the sport's biggest stars.
So what kind of bike do you ride today, Nick?
XR100.
Oh, yeah? That's a pretty neat little bike.
Scott Summers is the winningest dirt bike rider in history. He won the Grand National Cross Country 8 times running. He retired last year due to a career-ending injury. Summers says he likes the range of experiences available at the Fall Fun Ride.
I'm an ex-professional motorcycle racer. I raced in the GNCC series, which this place has hosted for probably 15 years.
You still ride?
Yeah, I still ride quite a bit. In fact, I have a couple of bikes here I'm going to go out and play on here in a little while.
Now, when you go out and play a little bit harder than some of these guys? Or?
Well, I think that's what's neat about this game is you can go out there and go as fast as you want to or as slow as you want to.
As the Fall Fun Ride goes on, riders blaze by wearing naughty smiles. Around midday, 11-year-old Adam Mills and his sister Emma assure me that if I were to ride, I'd smile too.
Could you teach me to ride if I need to learn how to ride?
Easily.
Really? I wouldn't hurt myself too bad?
Oh, what are you planning on riding?
Only a few broken ribs. Doesn't matter.
Say that again?
Only a few broken ribs. Doesn't matter.
Well, that all depends on your age.
That's Jack Bailey, co-founder of the Volunteer State Trail Riders Association. They host the Fall Fun Ride. Jack rides all the time, and he says a few broken ribs is not a small thing.
I guess if you're 7 years old, a couple of broken ribs isn't a big deal. Myself, I'm 48. I've had a couple of broken ribs. It's a big deal.
Big deal or not, I can't stop myself. I'm compelled to straddle a huge orange machine that stands as tall as my rib cage. But before climbing on, Blake Bell, an 11-year-old veteran, helps me, a 35-year-old novice, suit up.
Well, let's get this gear on. What do you say?
Okay. First, you need to put your knee pads on.
All right. This knee pad?
Yes. It'll protect your knees when you crash.
When I crash?
Yes, if you do crash.
Okay, so it's not a foregone conclusion that I'm going to crash?
Yes.
I pull on bulky black boots, slip on a pair of heavily padded Kevlar pants, strap on elbow guards and a chest protector, gloves, goggles, and a helmet so tight that my eyes water. And I'm off. My wife's going to kill me.
Oh, God.
Can you handle it?
I don't know. This is scaring the stew out of me.
No, go easy. It's slick going up the hill.
It's slick?
Oh,
after a few false starts and a lot of help from trail spotters, I ride late into the afternoon laughing like a child. The kids are right. I can't stop smiling. I ride until my arms shake and my legs ache. I won't even talk about my back.
Now, if he's in his cabin, I'd abuse him.
Late that night, I join Blake Bell and his family as they lounge about the fire and tell lies. As smoke rises, curls up, and dissipates, I begin to understand. Moms, dads, brothers, sisters, all muddy, all worn out, surround the fire. Jack Bailey says that's what it's about. Family.
Well, I'll say it this way. I don't know many dads who can say, I spent 26 hours straight with my 14-year-old son this weekend. At best, they say, we talked for 15 minutes. It's a remarkable family sport.
Now at day's end, as riders spin their motorized yarns, I drift off to sleep and dream of one day teaching my kids to ride, owning my own dirt bike. In my dream, I hear the vroom, vroom, vroom. For Only a Game, I'm Hal Humphreys in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee.
Here comes the dirt bike. Beware of the dirt bike, 'cause I hear they're coming to our town. They got plans for everyone, and now I hear they're over the sophomore jinx. So you had better check it out.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Peter Jay at WLRN in Miami and Peter Kearney and Michael Danchishan at the CBC Studios in Toronto. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, see photos from the Fall Fun Ride, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, World Rock Paper Scissors champion Peter Lovering explains his plan for world peace.
Everything can be solved through systemized gambling.
Right. $50 on the rock. I mean, a scissor. The paper. I never was any good at that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Soul crushing dirt bike. Self-propelled dirt bike. You see, I never thought I'd understand. That bike took me by the hand. Now I ride, ride, ride.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.